This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Because what Dora really is a tool to sell kids stuff. Nickelodeon and Mattel decided they had to expand the market.
That's Susan Lin, author of Consuming Kids. We'll talk to her about the book and to Adriana Barbaro, producer and director of a new film inspired by the book.
So the next thing you know is that they hooked up these things to seesaws. So now when the kids are playing in their playground, they are pumping water. So Kid Power is helping to bring water to people.
Later we talk with Alan Weissman about Gaviotas, a village to reinvent the world. It's just been reissued by Chelsea Green Press. But first, Consuming Kids. A new version of Dora the Explorer is coming out from Mattel Toys and Nickelodeon this fall, aimed at the tween market. The new Dora is a sexier, more glamorous version of the intrepid tomboy who's captured the imaginations and brand loyalty of toddler girls the world over. The new Dora is a fashion doll. It actually plugs into a computer, prompting girls to go online and accessorize her, buying lots of new products along the way. The tween market the doll aims for is defined as between 5 and 11 years old, spanning kindergarten to middle school. It's an invention of the $17 billion marketing industry targeting kids from infancy through adolescence. It's vying for the $700 billion in dollars spent each year on an endless progression of products for kids, from tarted-up Bratz dolls to video games filled with violence and gore. It's consuming our kids, say Susan Lin and Adriana Barbaro. Lin is director of the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood and the author of Consuming Kids, Protecting Our Children from the Onslaught of Marketing and Advertising. The book came out in 2005. And now Adriana Barbaro of the Media Education Foundation has made it into a terrific movie. They both join us on today's show. Adriana Barbaro, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And Susan Lin, welcome to Writer's Voice as well.
Thanks. It's great to be talking with you and Adriana.
Now, Consuming Kids takes a look at the multi-billion dollar marketing industry that targets children. And I was shocked to read that kids are bombarded with over 3,000 commercial messages every day. Is that really possible?
Well, it's not just that children are bombarded with commercials. Commercials are really just the tip of the iceberg. And what's really happening now that's unprecedented is children are actually immersed in advertising for most of their waking hours. To put this in perspective, in 1983, companies were spending about $100 million annually targeting children with marketing. Now they're spending about $17 billion.
Wow. Now, this is a big demographic, children, because it's not just the kids. What's really being targeted is the parents through the kids.
What's really being targeted, it's actually both. With children, marketers really get like a twofer. What they're building is cradle-to-grave brand loyalty, and they talk about that. They want to own kids. They want to get them when they're young. If you get a child by two, you have that child for life. So they're getting that, and then they're counting on the children to nag their parents to buy products. So it's really works both ways.
And this nag factor, I mean, I am a parent. Now I'm a grandmother, actually. And I can remember with my kid, that was back in the 1980s when he was young, that nag factor was a constant thing that I had to deal with. And it was very stressful to our relationship.
Yes, in fact, studies show that advertising and marketing does foment family stress. And the reason, or one of the reasons that it does that, is because of encouraging children to nag.
Well, talk more about that. And you, Adriana, did you talk to kids about this? Did you talk to parents about this?
We didn't have the opportunity to talk to kids about the nag factor, but we did a lot of studies to show the Center for New American Dream had done a study to see how many times a child will nag until a parent will give in, and a child will nag up to 9 times before a parent will finally say yes to a product.
And so say more. You, Susan Lin, you're a psychologist, an instructor in psychiatry, actually. What does this do to the relationship between children and parents?
One of the things about being a parent is that what seems to come along with it is this deep, innate desire to want your children to be happy. And because we live in such a commercialized culture and the children are bombarded with marketing and parents are bombarded with marketing telling them that children will only be happy if they have the things that corporations sell to them, there gets to be a lot of focus on stuff and the need for stuff and parents feeling guilty if they don't buy kids stuff. And then the kids, you know, are exposed to all this marketing that's encouraging them to nag their parents for it.
And what's at stake here? How much money are we really talking about in terms of the kid demographic, the spending?
Children influence about $700 billion in purchases a year.
That's a big number.
Yes. Yes, it's big bucks. And one of the things that I think is so troubling is that the marketing industry tends to spin it as though parents should just be able to cope with this and parents should just be able to say no, but that they should be able to work with child psychologists to bypass parents to target children directly. And somehow the parents are just supposed to cope with this. And of course, parents need to take responsibility for their children. Parents do need to learn how to say no to their children and when to say no to their children, and that's very important. But I think that it's just unfair to expect one family in isolation to cope with this, you know, huge industry working with child psychologists day and night to bypass parents, target children directly with messages that may or may not be good for them.
So they're really stacking the deck against parents, and parents themselves are kind of encouraged to feel very insecure about themselves as parents.
Yeah, a lot, especially with the infant DVD market that came out over the past 5 years. We've just seen an explosion in marketing to infants and young children. These videos that claim to be educational and give kids a head start, and that really is exploiting parents' vulnerabilities to want to be a good parent, to get their child in front of media early. They think is a good thing because they're being told this, but the research that's out there says that children 30 months of age and younger don't learn anything from an electronic screen, and there actually can be damage to them, that there are vocabulary delays, speech delays, attention problems later on. It really just gets them hooked to a screen and hooked to characters earlier and earlier.
Hooked to characters, you mean like hooked to the brands?
Hooked to the brands. Dora, SpongeBob. I mean, some of these shows may do good educational work for a child at a certain age, but the only other place that a child will encounter these characters is on commodities, is on things to buy. And it really just, in an early age, tells them that they identify with a brand, and if you see that brand, be it on carrots, be it junk food, a book bag, clothes, whatever it's on, is that I need it, it's for me. And so I think that just escalates over time. It starts with Dora. Where does it go next? Abercrombie and Fitch or Hummer and Disney Vacation. It just kind of keeps going that you need the latest and greatest and the best of everything that is the brand you identify with.
Now, you said, Adriana, that the kids, actually infants who are spending a lot of time in front of a TV, show delayed language. You know, even if it's an Einstein, baby Einstein, they would show delayed language. Why is that?
Well, I think Susan might be able to add to this, mm-hmm. too, but it's overstimulating for them, and that pretty much they learn more from putting a block in and stacking it themselves than they do from watching something on the screen doing that or from hearing the repetition. They learn more from social interaction with a parent or with someone else that's speaking to them and teaching them rather than watching a screen.
There's not a lot of research on babies and videos. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for children under the age of 2. Initially, they did it precisely because there was at that time no research about what the impact was. But what we do know is that, you know, as infants, children's brains are developing at a really rapid rate, and they're very vulnerable to environmental influences. But the research that does exist, first of all, suggests, as Adriana said, that the videos are not educational, and there is some evidence that they may even be harmful. And one of the reasons I think that videos are not particularly educational for children under the age of, say, 2.5, is that babies really learn with all of their senses. they learn by touch and by smell and by taste, and not just by looking at things. And so what we really want with babies is, first of all, to have them engaged in loving relationships, but also to be able to explore the world and to initiate that exploration of the world. And what these DVDs do, or these computer programs for babies, is actually deprive children of creative play, which is really the foundation of learning, hands-on creative play, and also train them to turn to screens for stimulation and for soothing. And that's exactly where the media industry and the marketing industry wants kids. And so, you know, as we have these babies, you know, immersed in videos practically from the moment they're born, we really have to ask ourselves, you know, do we want to raise a generation of children who are either bored or anxious when they're away from a screen?
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susan Lin, psychologist Susan Lin, who's also director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. And we're talking with Adriana Barbaro, who is a filmmaker with the Media Education Foundation. Susan Lin is the author, and Barbaro is the producer of a film about the book Consuming Kids. Now, first, tell us a little bit about this history. Back in the beginning, you mentioned, Susan Lin, that this has changed over time. So bring us back. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid, and this is going to date me. You know, there wasn't Mickey Mouse. I had a set of Mickey Mouse ears. To some degree, I had brand loyalty to Howdy Doody and Captain Kangaroo. On the other hand, it wasn't just a quantitative difference in terms of being less. There was a qualitative difference, wasn't there?
I think that there is both. And children have been targeted by marketers ever since, you know, there was the beginning of any kind of mass media culture. They've always been targeted, but they're not targeted the way that they are now. I mean, comparing the marketing of yesteryear to the marketing of today is like comparing a BB gun to a smart bomb. These days, it's honed by child psychologists. It's made possible by this incredible, sophisticated, and miniaturized technology, and it's brought to us by billions and billions and billions of dollars. So when you were a kid, you say that you're a grandmother now, so there were maybe four television stations, mm-hmm. and there was radio, and that's really about it. But that's what your parents had to worry about if they were going to try protecting you from commercial culture. It was actually relatively easy. But these days, parents have to worry about television and the internet and marketing on cell phones and marketing on MP3 players and marketing on video games and DVD players in the back seats of parents' cars and portable DVD players. And marketing in schools is escalating. And also brand licensing has escalated. When you were a kid, there were a few products, a few media characters that were licensed. I mean, Disney had some, and, you know, there was Hopalong Cassidy and some cowboys and things like that. But now, you know, blockbuster films come out practically every month with just tons and tons of products associated with them. For instance, and television programs as well. For instance, take the Disney princesses. What Disney did with Snow White and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and Beauty and the Beast, Disney packaged those into one brand called the Disney Princess brand. There are 40,000 Disney Princess items on the market today.
Wow.
And not only that, it's not just that there are the products and that kids see these films once in a movie theater. They see them over and over and over again.
Well, what is the difference? You know, I have a 5-year-old granddaughter, calls herself Princess Paloma. She's very much into the princess idea, and some of it is wearing princess costumes. I mean, it doesn't seem to have harmed her in the sense that it is a spark to her imagination. So where's the problem here?
Well, it's certainly possible to play about princesses in a creative, meaningful way. I mean, we could have a discussion about whether it's really good for girls to want to be princesses and what that means. I mean, you know, what is a princess really, but, you know, essentially a rich white girl with servants. So, you know, we could have that discussion. But even aside from that, when we're talking about commercialism, what we're talking about is the fact that the princesses that children create have already been created, and they come with scripts. And they have to look a certain way. They have to act a certain way. And because children, as I said, they see these films over and over and over again, and then all their toys come from their film, there's no room for creativity, and there's no room for them to make the play meaningful.
We look at this also in the film. The children's imaginations are being limited through all of these branded products and media products. It's the corporation stories. They're telling kids the stories, and if you don't know the story, kids can't play together. So even though maybe your granddaughter has the princess costume, she has a certain story around it, and she may branch off of that story. But to play with others, a lot of the time you need to know the story. You need to know the characters.
So, in fact, what you're saying is that the marketing industry is kind of colonizing the space inside children's minds, their very imaginations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main points we make in the film is that it really is corporations taking over kids' imaginations, that they don't have that free space anymore because they're always surrounded by media wherever they are.
And you also say that they want it that way, that that's not just an inadvertent side effect of their campaigns, their marketing campaigns, but that they don't want kids to have imaginations.
They wouldn't sell all their products if kids did, because when you think back, I mean, children, young children, you give them a box and they can play all day with a box or pots and pans or blocks or whatever it is. And that's a problem with media-linked toys, is they can only do one thing. If you have the character, maybe he can only do this, and it limits what they can do with the toy and the type of play they have with the toy. So they have to buy more and more of the toys in order to play more.
And there's another aspect that comes out in the film and in the book by you, Susan Lin, Consuming Kids, and the movie as well by the same title. And that is how marketers are using children to market to other children.
Yes, and the film does a really great job of talking about the Girls Intelligence Agency, for instance, which is a market research firm that really claims to have tens or hundreds of thousands of girls actually working for them in a way. And what they do is they've created something called a slumber party in a box. And so they encourage girls, first of all, to go online and develop relationships with these market researchers, and they kind of flatter the girls, and they say, oh, you know, we only take popular girls, we only take girls with a lot of friends. And, you know, these are girls who are, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, maybe a little older, and they're vulnerable, you know, to wanting some kind of affiliation. So they develop relationships with these market researchers, and then they're encouraged to have a pajama party where they're sent all sorts of products to try out with their friends. And the girls are encouraged to video themselves at the party using the products. And then it's sent back to the company. The girls think it's sent back for editing. But also what the company does is share that video with their clients.
The toy manufacturers.
Or the makeup manufacturers or the food manufacturers or you know, whatever it happens to be. And most of the websites for children today do have what's called a viral link connected with them. Their kids are always being encouraged to email this website to a friend.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And we're talking with Adriana Barbaro, producer and director of the film Consuming Kids, put out by the Media Education Foundation, and also with the author of the book Consuming Kids, Susan Lin.
This is all pretty shocking. I find it even more egregious. You mentioned, Susan Lin, that this has come into the schools. Talk about that.
Yes. In 2000, the federal government did a study of marketing to kids and came to the conclusion that essentially it was a growth industry, with Coke and Pepsi leading the way. Marketers love to target children in schools because they have what they like to call a captive audience. The kids can't leave. You know, they have to be in school. And so there's all kinds of marketing in schools these days, and that's escalating in part because schools are struggling so much for funding that they're kind of, you know, looking anywhere, either to get funding or, you know, to get materials. So we have schools selling gymnasiums, selling the naming rights to their gymnasiums, for instance. We have Bus Radio, which is, you know, a company that is bound and determined to market commercial radio, to play commercial radio to children on school buses so that, the kids on the buses are forced to listen to 8 minutes of commercials. There's Channel One, which is, you know, corporate sponsors newscasts in schools. And there's also corporate sponsored materials, teaching materials. Ronald McDonald goes into schools to teach reading, to promote values, and also to promote healthy living.
How is this different from the Weekly Reader that we had when we were kids? I mean, that's also was a private company, wasn't it?
I don't recall ads in Weekly Reader.
No.
I mean, I'm sure it had a particular point of view, but it's not the same as a teacher handing out math problems with the McDonald's logo on the paper. It's not the same as kids having Pepsi or Coke soda machines every 50 feet in the school. It's not the same as naming, you know, gymnasium after, what is it, ShopRite or something like that.
Right. There's also a kind of, you say there's been a shift in the advertising, not just that there's more of it to kids, but a shift to what you call symbolic advertising based on the social meaning of products. I'd like to invite both of you to talk about this. First of all, what does that mean? What is symbolic advertising using social meaning?
Well, we've had this shift in marketing where we've moved from selling just the product, where you see, if you look at older ads, where you look from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, a lot of ads will say, isn't this fun to play with? Look how fun this toy is. Or this cereal tastes good. We've now moved to this symbolic marketing, which pretty much is it's tied to a brand. It's tied to a social meaning. So you want the product because the product is cool or the product makes you cool. So we'll see different ads if it's for food, if it's for sneakers, if it's for any clothing product where it says, you need this to be cool. And it really exploits children at that age are going through so many developmental stages. And one of them is acceptance and social status and peer pressure and wanting to fit in. And the message you're getting over and over again is you need this to be cool. This is part of your identity, the brand.
And so what does that do to the larger values in terms of what people, what children are, what messages are children getting about what's important?
Material values is really the underlining meaning of branding, is that it's about me now, and it's about me and these things, what I have, and instant gratification and materialism. And a lot of studies that are out there show that children who watch are involved with more media are consuming more, and their consumption patterns are higher, and they think they need more things for happiness and for satisfaction. And that's the message that kids are getting in the media everywhere, is that you need these things to be happy. And we all know, I mean, when you look at different research, that the things that do make us happy in life and do fulfill us aren't these outside things, looking outside for things to fulfill us. It's what's inside. It's relationships or doing something good for others and the people we have in our lives. But instead, kids are being taught, you need the product for that. You need this to make you happy. And I think it's really just setting kids up to be dissatisfied and for unhappiness. And so it's really a disservice to them because they're going to be chasing after the next newest and, you know, greatest, latest thing that's out there for fulfillment.
Susan?
I think that the notion that things will make us happy or that brands will make us happy works very well for corporate America. Because if you believe that things will make you happy, you go out and you buy a thing. And then we know, though, that things don't make us happy. So you buy a thing, you're not happy. And then what do? You go out and you buy another thing or a better thing or a bigger thing. And so it is a way to keep people consuming like that. And I also think that that message is particularly disturbing today. I mean, here we are in this with the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression. Adult, you know, newspapers and magazines and adult media is all filled with, you know, people are cutting back and they aren't spending so much. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence that anybody's cutting back on marketing to kids. Still, kids are still going to be immersed in the same old messages.
And even looking beyond the current economic meltdown, just to the fact that we have exceeded by 25% the carrying capacity of the planet. I mean, many people are saying that we need to learn to consume far, far less if we're to survive as a species.
Yes, and how are we going to do that if from birth children are bombarded with the message that happiness lies in the things that are sold to us? And I mean, there are very, very, you know, clear and important links between the movement to stop the commercial exploitation of children and the environmental movement.
Say more about that.
If children are being, you know, told constantly from birth that their well-being, their happiness, their sense of themselves lies in the things that they buy, what we're doing is training them to be consumers from birth. And that's antithetical to the notion that as a society, we need to cut back on consumption in order to preserve and maintain the earth. And if you think about it, a lot of the things that are sold to kids, I mean, it's all that plastic junk and all that stuff that just ends up in landfills. If you're an environmentalist, you really also, I think, need to be somebody who is taking a stand on marketing to children.
One thing I have to ask, though, is I'm of a divided mind around things like educational TV. I mean, on the one hand, Sesame Street is one of the hugest powerhouses of this kind of marketing to children. We talked about Dora the Explorer before. On the other hand, parents point to Dora and say, well, here she is. She's an adventurous girl. She's a great role model. Kids learn. Many poor kids are actually being, you know, are learning how to get ready for school through the TV, as well as other kids as well. So how do you judge what's good, what's bad, what to keep, what to throw away, what kinds of limits to put on things to preserve what's good and what's not?
That's a really great question. And it's very timely, actually, for you to bring up Dora, because Nickelodeon and Mattel announced that they were going to be launching a new Dora that was going to be a fashion doll, and that was going to link girls to a website where they could, you know, go cyber shopping and things like that. So, you know, here's this media character who was marketed as being a great role model for girls, and there's certainly a lot about Dora that was a great a model for preschool girls. But because what Dora really is a tool to sell kids stuff, Nickelodeon and Mattel decided they had to expand the market. And now we're going to have this sexualized preteen Dora who, you know, mostly seems to go shopping.
That's very dismaying.
It is. It is. Actually, there is a petition going around to save Dora. There's been a lot of outrage. But I think that that's what happens when we turn to commercial media companies to provide our role models for children. And the issue of public television is something that I struggle with a lot. I have worked in television. I worked with Fred Rogers. I came of age at a time when there was a lot of hope for public television. But the problem is that these days, we can't just think about a program anymore. What we have to think about is a brand. And so when we think about Sesame Street, we have to think to ourselves, can a television program be good for children if it partners with McDonald's, which Sesame Street does? Can a television program really be good for children if it supports itself by marketing kids toys that undermine rather than promote creative play, which Sesame Street always does? And creative play is the foundation of learning. So I think that what the makers of media would like us to do is just to look at the content of the program and make our judgments that way. But that's not how the children are exposed to these programs. They're exposed to them as a total brand. The kids don't differentiate between the toys and the program.
Susan Lin, author of Consuming Kids and director of the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. We're also talking with Adriana Barbaro, producer and director of the film Consuming Kids, put out by the Media Education Foundation. We've posted links on our website, writersvoice.net, where you can read about the Dora controversy. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guests are Susan Lin, author of Consuming Kids, a book that came out in 2005, and Adriana Barbaro, who's just made a film inspired by the book. We're talking about the mass marketing of consumer products to kids, targeting them even in infancy. I asked Lin, what can parents do to help their kids resist the influence of this kind of marketing?
Well, one thing that parents have to do, and this is the first generation of parents that I think really needs to take this seriously, is they really do have to set limits on children's exposure to electronic media from early on. And that's hard for parents to do, but it's something that is really essential, because if you start your kids out as babies being dependent on screens, it's much harder to wean them later. So what you want to do is raise children from the beginning of their lives who can invest themselves in the world and who can play creatively and who can take their pleasure from the things that they create and not just from the things that they buy. And also, it's helpful if parents find other parents
to do that. Now, let me ask you, when you say limit, do you mean limit quantitatively, or do you also mean qualitatively?
I mean both, actually.
So what might that look like?
Well, as I said, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for children under the age of 2. And I think that that's really important, because that's where children begin to develop their habits of engaging with the world. It's where they learn to explore the world and explore materials and take initiative, and it's where they, you know, the whole creative process really begins. So I think we really do need to, you know, do what we can to keep babies and toddlers away from screen media. And after that, I just think we need to set limits both on time and on quality. Both of those things are important. And it's important to do that when you're younger, when the kids are younger, because it's virtually impossible to do when the kids are older.
And Adriana Barbaro, you're with the Media Education Foundation, as the name implies. Is there a way to teach young children, elementary school children as well as high school kids, media literacy so that they themselves are more resistant?
Yeah, I think that's a real big piece, is that we can start talking to kids. And for parents, I think one is, like Susan said, the awareness is for parents to be aware. Because I think through all the research I did and all the different people I talked to, they did speak about recognizing, seeing changes in their children and seeing that, you know, that there are changes, but maybe not recognizing that it was media related. And I think when we put all those pieces together to see that, you know, the violence that's being sold to children, the effect it's having, and just talking to each other, because you may be on board with the obesity and the junk food marketing, and then once you're aware of the violence, but you may not be on board for the precocious sexuality, but really to see it's one industry selling all of these things. And so I think for parents to be aware and recognize that when a child's in school, I think a lot of parents think they come home and they turn on the TV or they turn on the video game or their, you know, their cell phone, and they stop learning and they're not taking that in. But everything that they're exposed to with media, they're taking that in, and there are effects from that and effects on their well-being. So I do think with media literacy that you can start talking to a 2-year-old, you can start talking to a 3-year-old. Different ways you need to talk to them about media, but then a way you talk to a 5-year-old or a 12-year-old. But how does it work? How is it affecting us? What are we seeing? Why do you like that character? You know, did you like how that character acted in the show? I think if parents are going to have their children exposed to media, they should be watching that media. They should be playing that video game before their child is. They should be aware of what's going on in it. And I think a lot of parents are so busy and I know they're so stressed on time that they may not think that that's important, but it really is if they are going to expose them to it and in order to really kind of give them the foundation, the tools in order to understand what's being sold to them. Especially even with adolescents, I think a lot of times when an adolescent knows they're being tricked or they're being played on, once they become aware of that, they say, wait, they're trying to sell me that, you know, and sell this to me in that way, and it kind of reverses it. They may not want that product anymore. So there is power in media education.
The thing that I think that we also have to keep in mind with children, especially young children, is it's important to talk to kids, and certainly with adolescents, media literacy is really essential. But at the same time, companies love media literacy because it kind of takes them off the hook.
Hmm.
And so we really have to deal with this as a societal issue. And that's why my colleagues and I formed the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. We're a national coalition that takes on major corporations around their marketing tactics. We filed a Federal Trade Commission complaint against Baby Einstein for false and deceptive marketing, for instance. And as a result of our complaint, the Federal Trade Commission put a lot of pressure on Disney, and they have actually significantly changed the way that they market Baby Einstein. They're not marketing it as overtly educational anymore. We've taken on McDonald's and the Bratz dolls, and I've actually had a fair number of successes around, you know, getting corporations to change some of their more egregious marketing tactics.
Anything that's happening right now other than the Dora one?
Well, not so much with Dora, but we are engaged, and actually this is relevant to Dora, we are engaged in a campaign to get Scholastic, which is an educational publishing company that does a lot of marketing in schools, to put the book back in their book clubs. We did a year-long look at Scholastic book clubs and discovered that 33% of what they're selling in these book clubs are either aren't books or books marketed with, you know, toys and trinkets. I mean, they were marketing things like an M&M video game and lots, in fact, of Dora the Explorer junk and lip gloss to girls and not books. So people can go to our website, which is commercialfreechildhood.org, and they can sign our petition. And also, if you know any teachers, we have a teacher's petition as well. We have almost 1,000 teachers.
Wow, that's wonderful. And we will link to that website at our website, writersvoice.net. We'll have links also to the Media Education Foundation and to the webpage of the film so people can take a look. I believe there's a trailer there that people can see. And also teachers can download a teacher's guide to discussion questions about that, all part of that media literacy. So I want to thank you, Susan Lin, author of Consuming Kids, and Adriana Barbaro, film producer and director of Consuming Kids, for coming onto the show today.
Thank you very much.
Go to writersvoice.net for those links we mentioned. You'll also find links to articles about the new Dora doll from both the company's and the opponent's point of view. And there's an image of the new Dora character to view, too. Next up, a village to reinvent the world. It's called Gaviotas. Is it possible to create a sustainable community in the harsh environment of a treeless savanna? Yes, if you use affordable small-scale technology that respects people and the planet. That's what the villagers of Gaviotas, an unintentional community in the largely uninhabited eastern part of Colombia, say. Journalist Alan Weissman chronicled the making of this community in his book, Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World. First published a decade ago, Chelsea Green Publishing reissued it late last year. I started out our conversation by asking Alan Weissman what that community looks like today.
If you fly over it, you go over a lot of immense, flat, empty country that looks like, you know, Holland or the Pampas of Argentina, except because of the amount of rainfall, it's nowhere near as fertile. And then, surprisingly, suddenly you start to see a lot of trees where there used to not be trees, because one of the things that Gaviotas has discovered how to do in trying to make an a very sparse environment inhabitable. They've discovered how to grow trees in a very remarkable fashion. And nestled in the midst of these tree plantations, which don't even look like plantations because they're overgrown with a lot of natural foliage as well, is this little village. The population fluctuates between 200 and 300 people, and it's just this utterly charming little place. There's a dirt airstrip, and there are houses in there that are made out of all local materials. One of the many things they had to do, because they were so far away from the cities, is to figure out how to minimize the amount of stuff they would have to import. And they discovered that the best building material in a fairly treeless plain was soil cement, which uses 1/14th part of cement to natural soil, which is frankly a way that we could be building everywhere in the world, just figuring out what is the proper combination of cement with the local soil, and that would save us a vast amount of cement and the shipping of that cement, etc. Anyhow, the houses are small but very charming. Several architects who have come out to live at Gaviotas have done some very interesting thing, making there's a lot of bird life out there. The word Gaviotas itself refers to an endangered species of tern that is actually quite plentiful in the rivers right around there. So they've got some houses that are sort of shaped to kind of look like a bird, with a little dip in the peak of the roof that looks like a beak, and the rest of the roof looks like wings. There's a lot of green space. Gaviotas, interestingly enough, because it was sort of a practical experiment, never evolved the government. There's always been sort of work groups to decide, well, what do we need to do next? And they don't have any laws or any rules out there. It's just always worked on common sense. The only rule that they have, well, actually there are two. One of them is no dogs, and the other one I'll explain in a little bit. But the no dogs rule is because they found out that dogs run off wildlife. And so you oftentimes see fabulous birds, you know, large egrets and bitterns and parrots, and you see monkeys and capybaras, which are these enormous rodents, though they don't look like rats. They look, oh, it's kind of hard to describe a capybara, except it's something that weighs over 100 kilos. It doesn't have that pointed snout that a rodent has. It almost has a simian-type face. There are tapirs, there's anteaters, there's deer. It's rather glorious every morning when you wake up in Gaviotas just to see the wildlife wandering around.
Now, you mentioned this this material that they constructed, kind of a small amount of cement to hold together the native soil. That's kind of indicative of their whole approach to technology. You have some other examples, like a kid-driven water pump. Could you talk about that and how they see technology? What is their philosophy?
Gaviotas, interestingly, has never really evolved a philosophy, or did not start with a philosophy. This was a totally unintentional community. Again, it was an experiment just to see, could an area that's so remote, that had no infrastructure, no roads, no electric lines, no anything, could it be made livable? So what evolved was an ethic of minimizing the amount of stuff that they brought there, because it was expensive to bring stuff out, and reusing materials that they did bring, and using natural materials that were available, but not overusing them so they would run out. They have brought out a certain amount of metal because they needed to pump water. And a couple of their implements that they designed after many experiments, and a lot of these people who came out were mechanical engineers in the beginning, many graduate students from a mechanical engineering department of Colombia's finest university, the University of the Andes in Bogota, came out there, and some of them never left. They devised eventually windmills that were made out of aluminum. They don't look like your conventional windmill. The blade looks like the cross section of an airplane wing, and that's exactly where the design came from. They got it out of a NASA manual. And this thing only weighs about 120 pounds, a light aluminum windmill that is sensitive enough to tap a soft tropical breeze, maybe 4 miles an hour, and yet strong enough to withstand a tropical storm. And that's attached to a double-action pump that they also invented that goes deep enough to pump clean drinking water, because so much of the water that flows on the surface is just loaded with organic material, and it's not good for human consumption. And then one of the engineers came up with an idea for a hand pump, and he literally dreamed it. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my, we have been doing hand pumps wrong forever, where a hand pump involves, you know, lifting a heavy piston that's in a casing up and down, and a combination of the weight of the piston rod and atmospheric pressure limitations keeps you from pumping much deeper than, you know, maybe 16 feet down. He decided, what, maybe we've got it backwards. Why not leave the piston stationary, put it in a lightweight sleeve, and leave the sleeve upside down? So using sleeves made out of PVC plastic, you know, regular PVC pipe, he came up with this pump that goes down to 40 meters. That's over 120 feet, about, you know, seven times deeper than a conventional well. And it's so light, even a kid could do it. When they made the prototypes, the children at Gaviotas, you know, were trying them out. And one of the kids was asking, you know, how does a pump work? And he's explaining the process of a lever and all that. And the kid said, like a seesaw, right? And then bingo. So the next thing you know is that they hooked up these things to seesaws. So now when the kids are playing in their playground, they are pumping water. In Gaviotas, it fills a wading pool, but Gaviotas over the years put hundreds of these into villages all around Colombia. So Kid Power is helping to bring water to people.
It reminds me of something you talk about. The founder is Paolo Lugari. As a teenager, he was at a talk given by a French priest, and the priest was asking the question, what is the purpose of development? The priest's answer is the purpose of development is happiness. And so talk about this kind of connection between technology, not just serving people's material needs, but their emotional needs as well.
If there's anything like a philosophy at Gaviotas, it's been that the way we should define prosperity is not by a constant accumulation of stuff. It does not involve constant growth. In Gaviotas, partly because they were so isolated and stuff wasn't all that available, the idea of prosperity became a no-growth concept, just constantly having enough and constantly having the means to replenish what it is that you need. I think that if there's one thing that impresses me most about Gaviotas, alongside the very clever inventions, I guess there'd be two things that I would say. In Gaviotas, no matter what you do, whether you are one of these engineers with a PhD, or whether you are a poor peasant who fled some violence elsewhere in the country, as unfortunately happens a lot in Colombia, and somehow, you know, straggled out, you know, with a couple head of cattle that weren't doing very well on these poor grasses out there, and discovered Gaviotas and moved in to stay. You know, whether your job is, you know, being an inventor, or whether your job is recycling things or working in the garden or, you know, working in the kitchen, whatever it is, you are there because you are providing something of value with your labor. And everyone is encouraged to constantly improve on the way things are done. Imagination is encouraged and rewarded. There's nobody making up rules and saying this is the way you have to do it. Some of the most interesting inventions at Gaviotas were created by people who did not have any degree whatsoever, but they used common sense, and as they learned from other people at Gaviotas how you make things work, they started coming up with ideas of improving them. So it's there's something so ennobling and energizing about being in a community where you are encouraged to be imaginative and be creative. And it's had a very, very practical effect. I mean, the fact that this place, which brings me to the second most impressive thing, has survived not only in one of the harshest physical environments in this country, but it's survived in a country with one of the harshest political environments in Colombia. Sadly enough, as you know, has been convulsed with civil war and then with, you know, the drug issue and the attendant violence on top of that. I mean, it's just an amazingly peaceful place.
In the midst of a country plagued by violence, no one has been killed in Gaviotas in the 40 years since its founding. One remarkable reason is the hospital Gaviotas built that treats all comers, whether impoverished farmers, indigenous people from the area, or even rebels and paramilitaries. The hospital was designed with ideas from residents, Indians from surrounding communities, and a young engineer from one of Colombia's top universities. Her name was Esperanza Connell.
Esperanza Connell came up with a design that had a roof created out of solar collectors and used an awful lot of glass that would let light come in. It was placed on a hillside, and it was a hillside that was actually created by Gaviotas using this wonderful building technique where they take burlap sacks and they fill them with soil cement, put them in place, stack them wherever they want them. They just get them wet and they turn into rocks, which is, and eventually the burlap rots away, but you've got this very solid wall there. And into that, they built tunnels that were facing the prevailing winds, which come from the north. So wind enters into the tunnel and it flows underground at a depth of about 6 feet, which anywhere on Earth, you know, unless you're in permafrost, is usually around 50-some degrees. And then it enters through grates in the floor of the hospital and goes up through basically an aluminum version of an Arab minaret. They, you know, this very old technology, which is a very good technology for siphoning heat away from a building. And so we're only talking about being 2 degrees above the equator, and yet it's always cool inside of this building, just using natural cooling. The hospital rooms that they designed, they created with a technology borrowed from the coffee industry, with ceilings that actually crank open, just like a double-hung window. So when you're lying there in bed, you know how depressing it is to stare at the ceiling when you're ill. If it's not raining, they open the ceiling so you're looking at the sky. There was a village, still is, a village of indigenous people, Wayibo Indians nearby, that found even that to be oppressive, because the Wayibo, when they are ill, the idea is not to be walled off from your community, but to have your community around you. So they built a wing attached to the hospital made out of thatch, traditional, we call them ramadas here, but maloka is the word down there. And instead of hospital beds, there were hospital hammocks, and a sick Wayibo would lie in a hammock and all his family would come and hang their hammocks all around him. So there were just numerous very, very clever things that they did for this hospital. A kitchen that had pressure cookers that ran off of solar energy, a solar pump that was constantly pumping through a closed system, superheated cottonseed oil around these aluminum canisters that work as pressure cookers, a grill that was running off of natural gas that was being derived from cow pies. Gaviotas for a while had a herd of cattle. They don't have cows anymore because it just turned out not to be the most ecologically appropriate for the area, but they were collecting cow pies and just putting them in a vat, and the methane generator off of that was enough to run the cook stove in the hospital.
Despite its ingenuity in solving many problems that face communities, especially poor ones, around the world, Gaviotas doesn't promote itself as a model. I asked Alan Weissman, why not?
Gaviotas prefers to encourage encourage people not to copy them directly, but if they're going to be a model, what should be modeled is not their physical plant, but their approach. The idea is be flexible. Look at your own environment that's around you. Look to see what's available without great cost. Look to see what you can use that is easily renewed, and start from there and figure out what you can do. They're not purists. They realize that we live in an interconnected world and that it's okay to import some things as long as you don't get so excessive that you're totally, totally dependent on stuff that you import. And the stuff that they have imported, they've learned to recycle. I mean, some of the metal that is used in their equipment has seen many different incarnations there. It's sort of a common sense approach to minimizing the amount of materials that you need.
But Gaviotas hasn't kept its innovations all to itself. It's teamed up with poor urban communities in Colombia to bring small, appropriate technology that leaves a light footprint on the planet. For example, solar collectors.
One of the most effective things they've done is to take this solar technology that they have perfected on the cheap. And this is really important because they had very little money in the beginning, and also because they live in a poor part of the world, the tropics. They always wanted their technology to be highly affordable. So not only did they come up with solar collectors that work extremely, extremely efficiently, but they're very inexpensive to build. And during the 1980s, a progressive Colombian president discovered Gaviotas, recognized how valuable they were, and gave them government contracts, which resulted in some large urban developments, housing developments, all using Gaviotas solar technology, not to create electricity. That's pretty sophisticated stuff, photovoltaic, and Gaviotans, they'll use it sparingly, but it's imported technology. But to heat water will save, if you can use the sun to do that, you'll save minimum 20% of the energy cost of nearly any building. So there's one housing complex in Bogota, Ciudad Tunal, that's the biggest one in the world, heated completely, or whose water is heated completely with solar energy. There's about 40,000 people who live there, seven-story high buildings. And they have repeated this in many different places. In fact, at the American Embassy, you recently bought some Gaviotas water heaters. This is technology that we could be using anywhere, even in northern climates like our own. I mean, I've seen solar collectors used very efficiently in Germany at latitudes higher than that of Massachusetts. So this is stuff that we can do, and this is a very simple and inexpensive, relatively inexpensive technology that Gaviotas has proven that you can do even in a poor country.
Alan Weissman is the author of Gaviotas, which has just been reissued by Chelsea Green Press. He's also the author of the 2005 book, The World Without Us. You can go to writersvoice.net to see images of Gaviotas.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.